Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Wednesday morning. It's May 14th. Currently, we've got 34 degrees under mostly cloudy skies forecast today and a stray snowflake here and there. National Weather Service today calling for chances of rain and snow showers to continue throughout the day, looking for a high of 45. And Heber City is at 39 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. On the phone, we've got ABC Forecast Center's Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning, KPCW listeners. Here's a look at your forecast for your Wednesday for the Wasatch Back. We've got more unsettled weather conditions expected across the area. Look for periods of scattered showers, maybe a couple of rumbles of thunder in the afternoon. And in the high mountains, we're talking about the potential of more snow showers developing as we go throughout the day. High temperatures will climb into the mid-40s there for Park City. We'll see highs only in the low to mid-50s for the Heber Valley, so well below average temperatures will continue today with a good chance of scattered showers and a few rumbles of thunder, and again in the high mountains, even some snow showers developing. As we go throughout tonight, we'll continue that unsettled weather pattern with off and on periods of scattered showers continuing to make their way on through the area, with temperatures once again dropping near the freezing mark in both Park City and the Heber Valley. Don't be surprised to see some of those snow levels drop down a little bit more, maybe as far down as about 5,000 to 7,000 feet. So yeah, don't be surprised for that. Otherwise, as we go throughout the day on Thursday, there will be a chance of a few scattered showers and rumbles developing in the afternoon, but the chance will be less than today. High temperatures will be back near 50 for Park City in the afternoon, with highs in the upper 50s for the Heber Valley. As we head into your Friday, that's the pick day for the rest of the week, with partly cloudy skies expected. Temperatures will start off into the mid-30s, but as you go throughout your Friday afternoon, look for high temperatures to climb into the mid-50s there in Park City, with highs climbing into the low to mid-60s there for Heber Valley. Now, as we go into the weekend, we've got another stronger storm system moving our way. That's going to bring us more changes ahead of it. We'll see gusty winds, primarily dry conditions on your Saturday. We'll see those temperatures climbing into the low 60s in Park City, with highs in the upper 60s in the Heber Valley. But Saturday night into Sunday, we're going to see an increase in chance of scattered showers and thunderstorms developing once again across the area. And yes, high temperatures will once again drop back into the mid-40s for highs for Park City as we go into Sunday into Monday, with highs only in the 50s, the low to mid-50s for the Heber Valley. So an unsettled weather pattern will continue into next week. From the ABC Forecast Center, I'm meteorologist Cedric Kane.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Park City Library Director Adrian Herrick-Wars, along with Angela DeJanos. We'll be talking about their new telehealth room and health fair happening this Saturday. Park City City Manager Matt Dias previewing the two city council meetings this week, today and tomorrow. And Heber Valley Chamber Executive Director Dallin Kosher calling in with a recap of yesterday's Wasatch Back Economic Summit, as well as a preview of some upcoming events. Later on, stay tuned for The Mountain Life. Today's guests include orthopedic surgeon Dr. Jocelyn Wittstein, who shares a holistic approach to preventing and treating osteoporosis and arthritis. Then former pro baseball player Jim Murphy has helped other professional athletes find their inner excellence. He shares how we can find it as well. All of that on The Mountain Life, of course, heard every Wednesday at 9. Taking a look at some local news at 8:10, a contractor died at Victory Ranch last Friday after his excavator tipped into the Provo River. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports that authorities called the man's death a tragic incident.
The Wasatch County Sheriff's Office says a 911 caller reported an excavator had tipped into the upper Provo River around 11:30 a.m. May 9th. Wasatch Fire Battalion Chief R.L. Duke says firefighters from Wasatch County and South Summit responded.
And at the time, nobody knew where the operator was. He was later located in the excavator, and that's where he was recovered.
Authorities sent a medical helicopter, but the sheriff's office says the 60-year-old died at the scene. The man had not been publicly identified as of Tuesday, and no official cause of death has been released. Deputies are still trying to determine what caused the excavator to tip over. Duke says no one else appeared to be involved. He says the man worked for a private contractor and was not an employee of Victory Ranch. Utah Occupational Safety and Health is aware of the incident and investigating too, according to spokesperson Eric Olson. The Wasatch County Sheriff's Office says the excavator was being operated by a private company performing bank stabilization work in the area at the time of the incident. It extended its thoughts and condolences to the family and friends of the victim. Victory Ranch did not respond to KPCW's request for comment Monday or Tuesday. I'm Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
The Park City Library is hosting a health fair this Saturday to celebrate the grand opening of its new telehealth room. In the studio with details, I have Park City Library Director Adrian Herrick-Wars, along with Assistant Director Angela DeHanos. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Morning.
Angela, let's start with you. And what is a telehealth room?
So our telehealth room is a private room which will allow patrons to meet with doctors virtually at the library. The room has a computer with a camera, a small privacy screen, and a health kit that includes a blood pressure cuff, thermometer, and oximeter. Our hope is that this resource helps community members who don't have a private place at home to meet with their doctor or who don't have the resources to travel to appointments easily.
Okay, so who provided like the blood pressure cuff and thermometer and stuff?
We received these health kits from the state library. We have three, one that checks out to the public and then two that we have in the room.
All right, and so where's that telehealth room in the library?
So on the first floor in our UCreate lab, we have it in the back space. It's actually called our UConvene room.
Okay, so it's separate from the rest of the lab, so there is privacy
Yes. Whenever
somebody wants to use it.
Mm-hmm. And it has a door, and to reserve the room, they just need to call the library, and we can set up the appointment for them.
Okay, appointments can be for what, half hour, an hour long? Or
However long is needed, and it would be best if patrons scheduled their doctor's appointment first and then contacted us.
Right. Okay. Because it's important that the room be open.
Yes.
So people need to
have
that appointment
Yes.
ready to go. Okay. And basically open whenever the library is open.
Yes. On Monday through Thursday, we are open 9 to 8 p.m. And Friday and Saturday, we're open 9 to 5. Sunday, 1 to 5.
All right. Let me see. So tell us a little bit about the health fair. As I mentioned, this will also serve as the grand opening for the telehealth room. And so when is the health fair happening?
It is this Saturday, May 17th from 2 to 4. We will have over 20 different local organizations tabling, giving out bilingual information about their missions and resources, including the People's Health Clinic, the Christian Center, Summit County Health, University of Utah, IHC, and others. We will also have a raffle with opportunity drawings, giving away prizes, including donations from PC Film, Lucky Ones, Deer Valley, and Olympic Park. So we appreciate them for donating. The University of Utah plans will offer a Insurance 101 class at 1:30. This bilingual class will teach the community about the importance of health insurance. The Hope Alliance will also hold a vision clinic on the third floor from 2 to 4 as well.
All right. So everything's going to be Spanish and English then?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. People can just show up.
Yes. And there'll be some light refreshments, healthy ones, of course.
Okay. So are you planning to make this an annual event? I think this is like the first one. Yeah.
Yes, we're hoping so.
Okay. Anything else you want to tell us about that?
No, just please come prepared to learn a lot about what our community has to offer for health, physical, recreational health, and mental health.
Okay. Adrian, it's budget season, of course, here in Park City Municipal. What's the library asking for?
We are asking for what we had this year. So we're in the fiscal year now. We've been well supported by City Council and our administration. We have a flat budget. So what we got this year, we are getting again next year. And we are proud that we do so much with that. My team creates amazing programs like Angela's talking about this morning with the health fair, our story times for kids, all of the resources that we have, the unique items that people can check out. So we are pleased that we are going to be able to do this coming year exactly what we did this year and continue supporting the community at a high level.
Sure. And with those flat revenues, I mean, the city had each department kind of go through its own DOGE or, you know, efficiency effort. Did you find some savings there?
Well, we really are committed to our programs. So we put a lot of our eggs in that basket as well as our electronic books, our physical books, and some of the back of house things like, you know, mail delivery. We were able to kind of streamline a little bit about how we do some of those things. So we didn't feel like any of the public services got sacrificed, more of the back of house items that we can do on our own. So we felt good about how we were able to streamline.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about the e-books. Again, I'm as an avid user of that.
Yes.
It's like, man, I have to wait like 6 months for a book.
That's a good point, Leslie. So we have Libby. I know so many of our listeners use Libby. It's a wonderful app you can download on your phone or your device. You can download e-books. You can download audiobooks. We are part of a statewide consortium through the Utah State Library. So libraries across the state have access to hundreds of thousands of books. That said, we're kind of all in line for those books. There's a lot of demand. And the state library puts in a lot of money for us to make sure we have access. But one strategy I use is to place holds on those items and just keep placing those holds. They will come. And then in the meantime, I also find books that I wouldn't have thought to read because they're available and they're super interesting. So even though it's a long waiting list and we all share that resource, it's so worth using. So don't give up, Leslie.
No, I'm a master of the hold system.
Likewise.
But again, so am I in line with everybody else in the state of Utah or just with the Summit County?
You know what? There are a couple of lines. Mm-hmm. So there are the broad lines for all of the resources we get from the state. And yes, everybody's in the line for that. But in addition to that, the Park City Library, and if you're a Summit County Library user, we buy individual books for our community that only our patrons can get in line for. So those items that we know are particularly interesting to Park City, we get extra copies of those. So you are in line for those, and the state is not in line for those. So you get first choice.
Yeah. And can you decide to, like, sell back those? I mean, again, when a popular book comes out, you know, mm-hmm. Kristen Hannah's the Women, right? I mean, it was hard to get.
Yep.
And then you probably buy a few extra because you know it's so popular.
Yes.
Can you then kind of return those and get some kind of credit once, you know, that kind of the furor dies off?
Well, that's a great question. And I think I'll let Angela answer that. She takes care of our cataloging and our acquisitions, so she has a little more information.
Unfortunately, we can't do a buyback system, but most of the books we buy have like a circulation limit. So after 26 or 50 uses, then they get taken away. So that's what's kind of difficult about ebooks. And if you think of it as a physical item, only so many people can use it at once, and there's licensing attached to it. So that's why the holds get a little unruly for popular titles.
Hmm. How did they come up with uses, that number? I'm surprised because I'm thinking a book gets a lot more uses than 26.
Yes, I think the publishing companies come up with those rules.
Okay. Anything else? I mean, besides the new telehealth booth, any other new programs that the library is offering at this point? I know you got something, it seems like, every day.
Yes, we would like to highlight on Saturday, May 24th, we have our Teen Zen Den, a class for teens to support to learn practices that support concentration and reduce anxiety. We have Dungeons and Dragons Night on May 15th. It is now a monthly program that we do bi-monthly. Come play Dungeons and Dragons at the library. And then we have our local speaker series with Dalton Gackle with the Park City History Museum on May 27th at 4 p.m. And he will be talking about life about town in Park City's mining days.
Okay, yeah, he's a wealth of information. That Dungeon and Dragons, I mean, is it something that people, you have to know what you're doing before you show up?
No, this is a program that beginners are welcome, and are more tenured players will help you learn as you go.
Okay. What are the library's most popular programs? Again, you offer something, you know, everything from meditation to Minecraft.
Our daily story times are very popular. We have three bilingual ones, two Spanish ones, and then five English ones. And they are, we have a wide range of attendees there. And then we are getting some traction with our craft clubs and origami on slime night. On Monday, we had over 60 attendees. So everyone got to make slime at the library.
60 people?
Yes.
Wow.
It was a hit.
It's a lot of slime hanging out in Park City. And then, Adrian, I wanted to ask about you because this week it was announced that Utah has bound its 18th book, I believe, from Utah school libraries. What's the library's position on book banning?
Certainly. Well, we are a public library, so we have different standards than, the school library. We haven't had any books banned from the Park City Library. However, every library does have something called a reconsideration process. So we want the community to care about our books, care about our library, and be actively involved in what we have in the library. If someone has a concern about a book, they can fill out a form, and there is a committee process that reviews the title. We proudly can say we've never had a book removed from the shelves of the Park City Library or even had many concerns about that. Our librarians do an amazing job with their collection development process, creating a broad array of resources for the public that really meet the needs of Park City. They work hard to put quality information in our building that represents all aspects of life, as libraries should, and we're proud of that. And we thank our library board for their wonderful backing of our resources and materials, as well as our Friends of the Library group and the public who use the books in our collection broadly and want those materials in our building.
Yeah, and I know that you saw the documentary that was at Sundance this year,
yes.
The Librarians. I think it was a hit with all of your staff members.
Yep.
So you've got it actually pretty easy here in Park City compared to some of what's going on with what communities kind of, pushing back on.
I will say that we are very fortunate here on the Wasatch Back. We have a supportive community that's highly literate. And I know that other communities are under great fire, with some libraries being asked to take hundreds of titles off their shelves. Librarians are resisting censorship across the country, and the American Library Association helps with that. The Library Association collects data every year, so we know which books are most challenged, and they provide support for librarians who are under fire, which is really important. And we just invite our community to let their legislators know how important books and information and libraries are so that we can continue to get support, not only at the local level, but at the national level. This is an important conversation right now.
Yeah. So I'm guessing all 18 of the banned books from school libraries are available?
Yes, in the public library. Yes, that is true.
Okay. You mentioned Friends of Library. You've got, again, hardworking crew, I know. Best invention there was the addition of the Venmo for the book corner there. Tell me in terms of what you ask the Friends for. I mean, I know it's stuff that you can't budget, or you don't have the budget for, and so what's at the top of your list this year?
Absolutely. So I always love to give a shout out for our Friends of the Library group, who does so much for us. They do our Labor Day book sale, which we hope everyone will come to. They would love your support and engagement. All you have to do is go to parkcitylibrary.org, click on About at the top of the page, then select Friends of the Library on the drop-down menu, and you can provide donations that keep their work possible. They do so much for the library, author events. They support books. They support the e-books that we were talking about earlier, local speakers. They provide food and veterinary care for our lovely guinea pigs that the kids love so much at the library. And they sponsor things like our sewing program, our crafternoons, music on the patio, which is so lovely, and it's going to start up again this season, our business center supplies for the public. So they do so much for us, and we cannot express enough gratitude for that group. Please support them, and please get involved.
Okay. Anything else either of you wanted to mention?
I quickly wanted to touch on our unique items at the library. It's our library of things for the community to check out and take home for 1 week. Some examples are hotspots for internet access, GoPro cameras with different mounting accessories, a portable projector, a portable scanner that scans pictures and documents, and a few different options to convert old audiovisual formats like VHS, 8mm film, and cassettes to digital.
I'm telling you, I've used that a few times. It's great.
More than just books at the library.
Okay. All right, Adrian and Angela, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thanks for having us, Leslie.
Thank you.
Well, Park City Local and Nepal Cleft and Burn Center founder Jim Weber will host an annual fundraiser to support the nonprofit. KPCW's Christine Weller has more about that.
The Nepal Cleft and Burn Center is a nonprofit organization headquartered in Salt Lake City. It's touted as Nepal's leading burn treatment center and its first and foremost teaching hospital for burn and cleft palate surgeries. Jim Weber, a Park City resident and longtime KPCW supporter, established the center through his work selling rugs. He started a rug and carpet factory with Tibetan refugees he met in Kathmandu and Nepal. Over the years of running the business and traveling back and forth to Nepal, Weber said he wanted to help the community.
I ended up connecting with an amazing humanitarian physician in Kathmandu, and it just became a no-brainer. I was going to support him and build him a clinic to operate out of.
Weber started the nonprofit in 2002, and the 16,000-square-foot hospital opened in 2014. It filled the gap left by other organizations like Operation Smile and Doctors Without Borders, which could only support locals for a few weeks a year.
Our hospital is a continuous, ongoing part of the medical infrastructure of Nepal, and we have met the need for cleft lip and palates.
Weber said the hospital originally focused only on cleft lip and palate procedures. That's because Nepal has one of the highest rates of cleft lip and palate births. He said it may be genetic or due to prenatal nutritional issues. However, his team also saw the need to help locals with burns.
Nepal has 30 million people crammed into a tiny space, two-thirds the size of the state of Utah, with a population almost of Canada. Combined with rampant poverty and a high rate of illiteracy, and they have a lot of children. And more than half of this 30 million population cooks over open fires.
Cleft lip and palate surgeries require a skilled plastic surgeon, just like burn procedures. So the hospital started providing burn treatments as well. Weber said in 2014, the hospital treated 200 burns. Last year, it treated around 2,000. Weber and his partners have now broken ground on another hospital in Nepal's second most populated area so they can better meet burn treatment demand. To raise money for the project, Weber is hosting a fundraiser May 17th at Salt Lake's Natural History Museum. A $135 ticket includes food, an open bar, a social hour, a silent auction, and live music. Weber and the Nepal hospital's lead physician will speak. Weber said the fundraiser is the Nepal Cleft and Burn Center's main source of income every year, and 95% of the money raised supports the cause. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
The Park City Council has two meetings this week. The first is this afternoon at 2 o'clock to discuss the top two requests for proposals for the Bonanza 5-acre site. Council also meeting tomorrow at 4:30 in the City Council chambers. In the studio with a preview of both meetings, I have Park City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so let's start with today's meeting. The RFP Selection Committee scored. There were five responses to your requests. You interviewed three of them, recommended two for the City Council's consideration, Brinshore Development and Woodbury Corp / Pinnacle Real Estate Development Group. So what do you know about these two groups?
Well, this is the second time that they have submitted proposals. So they're clearly interested in working with our municipality, and they have, I guess, deep or broad experience in the development industry. I think we're, you know, not surprised that one of them is a partnership. That was sort of prevalent through some of the other proposals, is that you have a financial firm or an equity firm get together with construction firms and a development company and make a proposal. And so these companies have sort of been there all along. They submitted in the previous iteration. They're here now. And I'm not surprised that one of them is outright a partnership.
All right. So How were these top two firms determined? I mentioned that there was some kind of committee.
Yeah, so fortunately we had more or less the same committee that we had the first round, which is a collection of municipal employees and members of our community that have evaluation and scoring criteria. They score their proposals, they interview their respondents, and they review the materials that are submitted. And ultimately, as you noted, they're making a recommendation to the mayor and council to sort of sit down and have the mayor and council act as the formal selection committee and do, you know, more or less the same exercise, but just stress test these again and run through the proposals, ask the question, meet with the principals. You know, what happens here will ultimately be a partnership that's likely 50 to 100 years for our community. And so I think this extra level of deliberation, this extra time that we're taking, is hopefully well spent.
Yeah, so what did this RFP include that the first one didn't? Because this is the second time that you've done this.
Yeah, I think there were several elements, I would say, of consequence. I think there was further definition and delineation on the affordable aspects of the project. I think there was additional detail and specificity with regard to parking, surface and underground parking. There were some minor elements about open space, accessibility, connectivity, but the most significant element was the municipality pushing in $30 million, not to exceed, of public money to support the, I'll call them the elements of the projects that don't have a standard return on investment. So a private sector coming in and providing deeper levels of affordability, more housing units, even subsidize market or commercial unit or maker spaces. Those are all elements that don't necessarily have a traditional return on investment. Where the municipality, if you recall, had raised the transient room tax probably 8 or 9 years ago. And so the mayor and council, working with the team, the project team on this, actually just pushed that into the proposals so people could build their plans around them, as opposed to having the applicants speculate about our level of commitment.
Yeah. Again, we've done this before. Project costs came in over $100 million. The city stepped back and really just started the process over from ground zero. So what happens if it's more than a $30 million commitment?
I think that will obviously be a discussion between the mayor, the council, the respondent, and perhaps the community. But you're right. When we looked at this previously, it was going to be, you know, really with the municipality potentially as the developer. And we've seen the municipality have a lot of success over time, developing the market, redeveloping the library, and other types of facilities. And we see cities and towns that want to create community development programs often be the developer. But in our community, things had gotten so expensive, and the development area is so complex and complicated with soils and water tables, and some of these elements aren't traditional in other cities and towns across the country, that we saw an opportunity to shed some of the risks, the labor, construction, inflation, and land use risks associated with development by partnering with the private sector. So if for some reason the city's investment needs to or is asked to exceed that initial $30 million, that's going to be a threshold question the mayor and council will have to discuss with the applicant publicly. But fundamentally, you know, we took money from the transient room tax to purchase this property and then hopefully have a development pattern here that is something that the private sector wouldn't be able to develop on its own because it has deeper levels of affordability, greater flexibility, more underground parking. It has these elements that the community seeks that likely don't have the same level of return on investment where the private sector just left to its own devices.
What about the Kimball Arts Center? Has an agreement been made on a parcel or a purchase price?
I think we're close. Mm-hmm. To be fair, we've been having some discussions with Kimball Arts Center, and they just, for all intents and purposes, I think appear very, very committed and more or less ready to go. Now, it's probably a little bit of a chicken or an egg problem. If we're looking for a master developer, do you solidify a lease in the middle of this process before the master developer is chosen? Do you do that concurrently, or does that come in after the fact? I'm not sure that any of those are wrong. None of those are mutually exclusive. They can be done. It really sort of just depends. And I think we're really close, seeing a great deal of commitment from the Kimball Arts Center. And council has signaled through the request for proposals that that's a very important element of the project for them.
Do we know what parcel is being considered for the Kimball?
No, not at the moment. I think there was some moving around of where, this sounds negative, of where we didn't want the Kimball Arts Center because some of its use is sort of maybe way out on the wing or way out on the corner. But that's something that we'll have to work out.
All right. And in terms of units, I mean, is that part of their proposal, that they're providing this many affordable units, this many market rate units?
That is fundamentally in the proposals and the types of questions and evaluatory criteria that the mayor and council will be scoring.
So how many affordable units are we talking about?
I'm not sure off the top of my head.
All right. What other mixed-use elements are part of this?
Well, like I said, there's other elements such as maker spaces and other sort of like creator and artistic spaces. There was a request for greater levels of connectivity and access, so individuals in the community can move through the development, and it's not just sort of these big, back east we would call them big city blocks, where sort of the massing on a city front prevents people from moving through and in between the property. So multiple requests like that that would drive costs up. Underground parking drives costs up. Additional connectivity, not just building block to block and allowing people to have access through these, they drive the cost up.
So like Engine House, are you talking about a land lease then for this partner?
Presumably, and that's part of the next step is if we select a respondent, we'll be engaging in what the community saw before with the Engine House, which is a pretty extensive, what we call an exclusive negotiation period, where we'd be working to obtain a pre-development agreement with the respondent. And that outlines the commitments to each other, the potential terms and conditions of a long-term land lease, and then some of the land use and planning aspects that would need to proceed.
All right. So will the council make a decision today, or just take it under advisement? Or
that's a fine question. I'm not sure. I know that they've done a lot of work over the last couple of weeks reviewing the proposals on themselves and scoring. I know that they're all looking forward to today. I can't say if they'll come out of this today with a respondent, but you know, fingers and toes crossed. We've got the project team ready, and if we want to continue deliberations, by all means, we will.
Okay, moving on to the budget, where council will be talking about proposed fee adjustments, including the new parking fees at Bonanza Flat. How much if you're not a city resident?
Oh, you stumped me there, too. I should have a note on that. I don't have that off the top of my head. I apologize.
Yeah, and golf fees also going up?
Yeah, well, there's a slight tweak there. A few weeks ago, we were looking at sort of two alternatives, and one of the alternatives sort of didn't have a rate for members of our men's and women's golf leagues that were outside of the Park City municipal limits. So there's an augmentation there of reducing that. There's also the addition of allowing our punch passes, which are a really popular element, which is you can buy punch passes for 18 holes, reducing those so someone can buy a $300 punch pass as opposed to a $600 punch pass, and then also adding into our rate structure an element for members of the military and veterans. Those are three requests from council that we're sort of tweaking things as we're coming down the line.
Okay. Now, are these the increased fees what will be used to help pay for the water charges that the golf course will have to absorb?
A component of that, over 3 years, I believe, we're sort of onboarding the costs for water at the course. The course has made great pains over the last several years to reduce its water consumption in a lot of strategic ways. We do have a relatively old water system underground. I believe it's 30 or 30 plus years old that will eventually need renovation. And the course runs on both sort of culinary water for restrooms and the golf club and other elements, and then raw water for a lot of the fairways and greens. And so there's a common approach here as we're onboarding the cost. Traditionally, the municipality had paid for the water altogether, but now we're having the enterprise fund pay for it. And this is a choice. You know, looking across cities and towns across the U.S., they all do it a little bit differently. And I think the mayor and council were concerned about some of the upward pressure on the rates of our water system. And someone's paying that cost no matter what. And so we thought, well, the people using the course should be paying for it, and we're bringing this in over time.
Okay. And again, are you figuring out how that multi-million-dollar irrigation project gets paid?
Well, figuring out, you know, not at the moment. You know, it's not something that's imminent. However, it is likely something that we'll have to borrow for. We are building a balance. We have a capital balance in our golf fund of several million dollars. But that balance is also used to buy carts. You know, the course once could buy carts maybe every 5 years, and then as utilization increased, every 4 years. And I believe now that we're sort of the most rounds ever. It's almost every three and a half years that we have to buy new carts. And we're constantly renovating pathways and cart paths and tee boxes. So part of that capital fund is an allocation that we use every year to maintain the course. And then hopefully we're building a balance to contemplate some type of a larger water irrigation project. But that's something of magnitude that we'll need to borrow for.
Okay. And then the ice arena also looking at increased fees. Looks like they're operating at about a $300,000 loss. Are they an enterprise fund?
I don't believe they are formally. They have a cost recovery goal, however, that is in our budget policies, which if I recall off the top of my head is around 70 or 80%. So the $300,000 subsidy that you mentioned is well within their target. And that's another thing that really runs the gamut as you look at cities and towns across the country. I've worked for another city or town. And we subsidize the absolute inverse. So we were subsidizing almost 70 to 80% of our ice rink costs. We are very fortunate here to have the resort economy and a lot of visitors that are coming from outside of town. We have lots of leagues and other types of play, and we're able to balance the scales differently in terms of maintaining accessibility, offsetting some of our costs. And for one of our recreation programs to have, you know, only a 20 or 30% subsidy, that's actually, you know, coming from where I came from, when I first looked at that goal, I said, wow, that's very impressive what they're doing here.
All right. You're recommending a 2.5% cost of living increase for your staff. That comes at a cost of almost $1 million. So where does that money come from if revenues are flat?
Well, twofold. I think relatively flat. You know, we are projecting revenue increases for next year. And when we start this budget process, gosh, almost 3 months ago now, we don't have reporting on the four biggest months of the year, our winter months. And so we're very, very conservative. And each month as we move throughout the budget process, we started to get better and better signals from the resort economy and the receipts. And so next year, I believe, you know, all told, roughly approximately 3 to 3.5% increase that we will be able to project. In the grand scheme of things, though, that's pretty flat. If you'll recall, I've been in here in some years, we've been projecting 7.5%, almost 9% increase, particularly out of coming out of COVID. So for this municipality to project a 3% increase, this is fees, fines, tax increases, sales tax increases. We think we can accommodate it by living within our means and the projection for next year. But another important story that I always like to mention is no property tax increase. There's no property tax increase recommended in this budget. This is merely people utilizing our services more, so paying for the services that they use, and then having receipts from the resort economy that continue to pay for our parks and our playgrounds and our lifeguards and our streets and our lights and our flowers and all the other things that we do as a municipality.
Okay. For Pride Month in June, it sounds like the city plans to display its Pride banners on the Main Street City light poles. Banners are not flags, so you're saying this is legal to do? Because we had a bill, of course, this legislative session that banned Pride flags on municipal buildings.
Yeah, that's our belief. We believe that the banners are well within the purview of the municipality, continue to do. It's consistent with the past years. Our expectation is if the legislature had a problem with that, they would have expressed that outright, but see no reason not to provide the same level of support that we provided in the previous years. And then obviously there's some history here. I think this is the fourth or fifth year, and then there's some elements on our transit system and otherwise, but we'll be adhering to the law. And then obviously there's a proposal here to have June become Pride Month in Park City.
Okay, so you're not concerned that the legislature, if they thought a banner was a flag, they would have used the word banner?
That's our belief. I think there was enough scrutiny to be had here and media reporting on this that our belief is if, you know, that was their intent, they would have expressed it, and we're well within the means of the law, and this is consistent with how we've handled things in the past. So just for us, it's rinse, wash, repeat. We received the proclamation pushing this forward to the mayor and council.
Okay. Wanted to get to the DoubleTree appeal. The owner of the DoubleTree appealed the Planning Commission's March 26 vote to deny the redevelopment project. The applicant has now requested to stay the appeal. What does that mean?
A little bit unconventional. I think stay the appeal is the ability to have a conversation with the mayor and council, as you noted. A little bit unconventional, but so the owner seeking a work session to talk about the redevelopment of their property. They had obviously had a height exemption. I believe they were seeking another story. And the Planning Commission, after an extensive deliberation, denied or was prepared, you know, denied that request. And there's a lot of other elements of this project that still have to be reviewed as well. Parking, connectivity, setbacks, open space. And so sort of two things happening here. I think the applicant is seeking to likely talk about the height denial and then some of the other elements, but there's still a lot of work that would have to be done at the Planning Commission. And so my guess is the applicant's coming in, going to have a work session with council and sort of talk about all of these elements in the picnic basket. And they have some rigorous time constraints. It looks like in their letter, you know, I read the letter before I came in here just to catch up again, but they're seeking a decision at least as a path forward by June 1st. And so that's a tall order, and we anticipate, you know, the council to really dig in on that. You know, what does that mean specifically for the applicant? What might that mean for the Planning Commission and for the mayor and council?
Yeah, the Bonanza 5 acre is still under that same GC zone. There has been talk about, because it's a there's affordable housing, that they might get some height exceptions. DoubleTree has also proposed some workforce housing. So it sounds like, if all things equal, they would get that height exception as well.
Yeah, I think it does sound like that. However, sometimes the devil's in the details, and I don't want to oversimplify. We're talking about land use and codes and zoning. So I think you're right. At face value, it does appear to lend itself that way. And I think that's some of the discussion that will ensue. However, there's a pretty rigorous criteria that would have to be met in order to obtain some of those additional heights or reduction in setbacks. And so I don't want to oversimplify what is otherwise a very complex land use proceeding, you know, 6 or 7 planning commissioners, legal teams, and otherwise that would, you know, run this through that filter and screening process.
Yeah. Real quick, I had asked Park City Film Executive Director Katie Wang last week about summer programming. She says that she's in the midst of some lease negotiations with the city. You were those, or is she dealing with you or somebody else?
She's dealing with friends of the library that were just on here. In fact, I think Angela and Adrian in particular. But I think, yeah, there's some initial discussions with the film series about perhaps expanding some of their screening offerings throughout the year. Long-standing partner, not uncommon that we come in here with lease amendments. I think just the other day we were extending PC Tots lease. So we have, you know, facilities throughout the community. We have tenants within those facilities. Obviously, the local film series is a longstanding tenant, and they have some additional ideas for expanding their programming, and they're going to make a proposal to the mayor and council that we'll consider.
Okay. Well, speaking of leases, what about White Pine? I don't think a lease was ever extended for them.
That's coming up in a week or two. I think that comes up either by the end of May or early June, that lease extension. You're right. I don't quote me on this. I believe it was a 3 or a 5 year lease, and then it has another 3 or 5 year extension, and so that will also come up for renewal, and any other elements that will be changed as part of that renewal.
Okay, Matt Dias, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Leslie. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
That's Park City City Manager Matt Dias. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the 5th Annual Wasatch Back Economic Summit was a sold-out event yesterday, and on the phone to give us his take on how it went, I have the Executive Director of the Heber Valley Chamber, Dallin Kosher. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. So, a new venue this year at the Grand Hyatt. How did that work out?
You know, the venue was beautiful. It was our first time there, like you said, and with the new venue, we were able to expand our offering and get a few more people there than we haven't had before. So it was really cool to see about 370 people there, and the Grand Hyatt accommodated those folks really well. We had some great breakout rooms and were able to hit 100 people or plus, and it was really nice. The staff was really on top of things and very professional, so we felt that it was really well. So there was some really good positive things that happened from our event yesterday.
Yeah, and so is that probably the best location for this event going forward, since it's kind of like right smack dabble in the middle of between Summit and Wasatch counties?
Yeah, that was was one of our initial ideas, to see if we can make this permanent home, because it's like you said, it's right in the middle between the two counties, easy access for both communities. There are some logistical things we need to work out, such as some of the parking to make that a little more efficient. We started maybe about 15 minutes late due to this, to get people into the into the facility after they were parking. So we'll figure that out in the future, but I think there's some great things that the Grand Hyatt can offer for our community, our summit moving forward.
Yeah, personally, I'd rather walk, but I was told there is no parking for that, which I was surprised, except for valet. Anyway.
Yeah, so I think in the future years, I think that maybe be able to use some of like the day skier parking. This year has just been under the using construction equipment and stuff for the lift, so that's why it was unavailable this year. So we'll make it work a little bit better next year for sure.
Great. Keynote speakers, you had three of them full of information. Any takeaways from you?
That's a great question. So we had some great keynotes. We had Ron Hetrick, Robert Spendlove, and Andreas Mueller-Schubert. They all talked about different things. So, it was really interesting. The takeaways I came away from that was that there are some positive things and some concerning things out there in the economy. But what I think is really helpful for people like us who are in that meeting is that I always say information precedes inspiration. So, what this information that we've received, what some of it was a little dire, some of it was hopeful. And how do we take that and turn it into to adjust our local economies to be better prepared for what might be lying ahead, or mitigate any things, or even use them as opportunities for success. So I thought that was a great some great takeaways for our businesses that attended yesterday.
Yeah, and the breakfast speaker, Mr. Hetrick, you said, I mean, it was a little bit concerning about what he was having to say in terms of just the number of people we have to work. And when we look at the kind of the Trump administration's efforts to deport undocumented or immigrants, that's very concerning when you hear that one in four employees here in Summit, Wasatch County are immigrants, and 37% or something of them are undocumented. So if those folks go away, what do we do?
You know, those are some very, very serious concerns, and something that I think is always on my mind as well, and not just from a national level, but like you said, a local level. I think what would we do if we didn't have all the number of workers to help fulfill these jobs? And I think some of the startling information that I saw was interesting is that the declining birth rates and kind of the potentially lowering of population, and if we don't have population coming from other places to fill those jobs, what how is that going to work? So I think there are some, I am hopeful, and I think that's kind of what Ron's end of message was, I'm hopeful that we can find some common ground solutions that will help us maintain those workers and help us continue to have folks here that we need to fulfill these jobs. And I know a lot of the folks in the construction and agriculture industries rely, and even the hospitality, like we experienced yesterday, some of our foreign-born workers, which is great to have them come to the United States and to work in our community. So yeah, those are some definite challenges that I think we need to be more proactive in us as a citizenry to say, this is what we need, this is what we want. And I think that'll go a long way.
Yeah, and I know that you folks use the resources of KPCW to record all three of those speakers, as well as the breakout sessions. Does that information, those audio segments, get posted on your website?
Yes, they'll be posted at wasatchbackeconomicsummit.com. And as soon as we get those back, we will post them as soon as possible and get them uploaded. And then we'll make it, send out an email to all attendees and all those who would like to catch up on those. Would be great to hear those. So we really appreciate the partnership of KPCW to be willing to do that and to take the time and effort to do that. And almost have to listen to it twice. I apologize, but thank you for doing that.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting stuff. I recommend that once it gets up, people have a look. Anyway, I want a couple minutes left here to talk about some upcoming events. You've got a Community Alliance cleanup happening this weekend.
Yeah, that's May 17th. We're going to be each year we try to do a community event where we do some cleanup with the trying to get Main Street ready for the summer. And the Community Alliance Main Street is hosting now. They're going to be, I'm just pulling up right this second, meeting at at 9 a.m. at the Tabernacle. So that's the main Heber City offices. And the idea is just to help maybe clean out some of the bulb outs, the flower boxes that are along the street, just to get things ready for the summer and do some planting here in another few weeks or a month to make our Main Street look alive. And I think this is a great way for us as locals to take ownership of our Main Street and love it and clean it up. And you know, we take pride in things we work on. So I think this is a great opportunity. I believe that the city will provide lunch after at the end. So from 9 to 11, come on down and meet us at the Main Street Tabernacle.
Okay. You also coming up May 20th, your chamber lunch titled What's Up in Wasatch. These usually sell out, so people should register now.
That is correct. So we will be at the Zermon again here next week. This is what we're trying to do here is to give, our summer season is our busy season. And we have a lot of things happening coming up here this summer. So what we're trying to do is give our businesses an idea of what to expect, either from a visitor perspective, like here are big events coming into town. How does this may affect your staffing and or how you might attract these folks into your business? Try to give them a big, clear view of that. And also working with our community leaders, Midway and Heber City, to say, here are some of the latest projects that they're working on relative to downtown reinvestment or business improvement. So it should be a good event. And we get the Zermatt, like I said, and just go to goheavervalley.com and click on our events and register there. So we have, we'd love to see you out there.
Okay, I'm going to leave it there. Dallin, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Again, goheavervalley.com, and coming up also on May 22nd is an after-hours mixer and a tourism roundtable.